Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf sacks ministers and officials who defied an order to return home and help fight the Ebola epidemic. Her information minister has been defending the decision.
We need all hands on deck. This is a time of deep need for our people.
And in Malawi, cabinet ministers have been asking for a pay rise of 600%.
Everyone who has come across this news is actually shocked to imagine that such a proposal was somewhere in the offing, because I think it is so unbelievable and incomprehensible.
Those stories and more on this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Health experts from the West African sub-region were set to wind up a two-day meeting in Accra on Wednesday, at which they have been reviewing strategies to curb the Ebola outbreak. They stress the need for more funding, for more emergency clinics, and for more protective gear for health workers caring for infected patients. But some measures to contain the disease, such as travel bans, are said by some to be hindering rather than helping efforts to beat Ebola, as we hear in this report written by Isaac Kelechi and read by Emily Sherwin.
Actions by West African neighbours have virtually quarantined Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea. How do we expect to get lessons learned from my country when we are not able to fly to Ghana?
Alusina Yila is with the Sierra Leone delegation attending the meeting. He expressed anger at travel bans imposed on affected countries by some African governments and Europe. He says such decisions are misplaced and are hampering the efforts to fight the epidemic. Musu Rule from Liberia shares Alusina's frustrations and says this move has an impact on the bilateral relationships between affected countries and those yet to confirm cases.
It's everybody's problem. We have intermarriages, we have student exchange, we have businesses. We cannot stop people from going to Liberia because of Ebola. This is killing our bilateral relations.
Apart from a lack of funds to establish emergency clinic centers, experts identified flaws in the healthcare system as another challenge facing affected countries. This caused many of the healthcare facilities assigned to dealing with the epidemic to work without proper personal protective equipment. But they insisted that preventive measures and education about the disease should be at the forefront in order to stop the virus from spreading further. Alusina Yila shares some lessons learnt so far by affected countries as they battle the spread of the disease.
Lessons learnt: clear coordination structure is paramount in the effective response of activities. Active surveillance with on-site lab facility is essential for early case detection and response. And most importantly, timely isolation of cases that will reduce household transmission.
But experts from countries yet to record an Ebola case are not taking things for granted. The meeting gave them an insight into how to tighten the preventive measures in their countries. Sana Sambu is the Ebola Disease Control Coordinator of the Gambia.
For sure, you can see in a forum like this, new ideas will come in, new innovatives, new knowledge. You know, it's a learning process. And as you learn, you improve on whatever you are doing. This will actually redirect our interventions and even our strategies, for sure.
Dr. Pierre Rolland of the Center for Disease Control in the USA facilitated the technical session for the meeting. He recommends reporting cases to health centers early on and providing logistics for health personnel treating Ebola patients in affected countries.
To stop the spread is a tracing contact. So you try to block the chain of transmission and then bringing these sick people back to the treatment center. So you need to have a good treatment center where people come early. They have a better chance of survival.
On Thursday, an extraordinary meeting of health ministers from ECOWAS countries will adopt the experts' resolutions. The coordinator of the health experts meeting, Dr. Apia Denkira, said the various recommendations from the experts focused on increasing funding and on informing the population on a large scale.
The resources are actually not getting down there, and we need to get the resources down there. We need to involve the people, everybody, that this is our line of defense.
The trend of the spread of Ebola in the coming weeks will show how useful these sub-regional deliberations have been.
That report was written by Isaac Kelechi. Ebola is causing enormous damage to West African economies, according to the president of the African Development Bank. Donald Kaburuka told the Reuters news agency revenues and foreign exchange were down, markets were not functioning, airlines were not coming in, projects were being cancelled, and business people were leaving. And just hours after he spoke, the French carrier Air France announced it was suspending flights to Sierra Leone. But Liberia is the country that has been worst hit by the disease, registering 624 deaths as of August the 20th. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has sacked ministers and government officials who defied an order to return home and lead the fight against Ebola. Lewis Brown is Liberia's Minister for Information. I asked him how many officials, ministers, have been sacked and which departments had they been working for.
Well, they work across the executive branch. Some are directors, some of our assistant ministers, some head of agencies, but exhaustive list is being compiled as we speak. The president ordered all who were working in the executive and have traveled for one reason or the other to return home and work with this process and providing additional support. We do need all hands on deck. And so with the expiration of that time frame, she's followed it up with a measure of dismissal, because part of the instruction was that if people did not return, it will be assumed that they've abandoned their work.
Isn't it going to be difficult to replace these officials at such a critical time?
We've had to make many difficult decisions. This certainly is one of those. But these are decisions that are necessary to enable this fight. For every democratic government must respond to the needs of its people. You know, the president herself canceled her own trip, which would have been historic, to the U.S. Africa Leadership Summit. Having done that, I believe she set the tone and set the right example. We need all hands on deck. This is a time of deep need by our people. And as they expect, our government will and must continue to be responsive. We made these difficult decisions. We will find in due time proper replacements.
More than 600 people have died in Liberia as a result of the outbreak. What is the chief obstacle facing the government as it tries to curb this epidemic?
Well, I didn't hear you very well. If you mean what is the greatest challenge, one is to continue to expand treatment facilities to make sure that our people have access to improved treatment facilities, Ebola treatment units. We are now reopening many of the hospitals that were closed. You know that this virus really attacked our public health system. Now we're working to reopen them. That's another challenge, to make sure that treatable ailments can get treated in our hospitals. At the same time, we need resources in terms of personal protective equipment, in terms of expertise. We do need, there are Liberians that are volunteering to work in these treatment units, but the most important thing is to provide them the guidance and the leadership in training them to be able to do these kinds of work. We need ambulances, we need food, we need medicine. So these are the kinds of challenges we face right now.
Lewis Brown, Liberia's Minister for Information.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
In Malawi, President Peter Mutharika has blocked a proposal for a six-fold increase in minister salaries. The proposal would have seen 20 ministers receiving just under $9,000 a month in a country where the average public servant's wage is $100 a month. So now that the increase has been blocked, does that mean that the ministers will automatically accept a lower pay rise? I put that question to Augustine Magalowondo, a political analyst based in Lilongwe.
I would think that would be the natural consequence, and I would have actually been too surprised if this kind of proposals to going to pass, because I think it would have been the most unpopular kind of decision this government would have made barely after 100 days of being in power.
It would have meant that the ministers would be paid more than the president. How have ordinary Malawians been reacting to this?
Everyone who has come across this news is actually shocked to imagine that such a proposal was somewhere in the offing, because I think it is so unbelievable and incomprehensible. And of course, I mean, whether this would have meant that the ministers would have been receiving more than the president, I think that's also something that obviously we would not have expected. And I think my general guess is that if this proposal was going to pass, I think would have been the most unpopular decision to take.
Do Malawians see a link between these demands for huge salary increases and the corruption which is troubling the country?
Linkage to make, but I think whatever can be said about this, I think one thing basically is that it raises questions as to what extent the government or the people who were thinking about this are sensitive to the realities that Malawians are going through.
How did this proposal get as far as it did?
I think until now it remains an issue of discussion, because as it is reported in the press, it came from the acting chief secretary, who basically is the secretary to the president and the cabinet. And under normal circumstances, I think this is something that must have also been discussed with the knowledge of the president or the vice president. And as to how it could reach that far, I think that's something that is really difficult to understand.
Last year, it was revealed in Malawi that officials had stolen $30 million from state coffers. President Mutharika has been in office since May. To what extent has he been able to restore confidence in the state and its institutions?
To be very honest, he still faces a challenge to really instill public confidence, because the cases which are being pursued in court remain under investigation and remain under trial. So there has been like no case which has been concluded. And obviously, of course, it's also a challenge for him in the sense that some of the people that have been included in his public appointments, and notably the Attorney General, who is the chief legal advisor of government, in a way, it casts a shadow of doubt in the sense of to what extent is their seriousness. So it's something that the president is yet to prove by way of more action and by way of ensuring that the cases are pursued to their logical conclusion.
But do you see Malawi extricating itself from this scandal?
Ultimately, I think Malawi has no choice other than to do the right thing. So it's also another challenge that Malawi faces, that its budget is also significantly dependent on donors who, under these circumstances, of course, are withholding their budgetary support. So there is only one reasonable way out, which would be basically to ensure that these particular issues are pursued to their conclusion, and that Malawi regains her confidence. But that is something that will be a tall order, and it's something that I don't see it like happening in the near future, but that would be what would be expected.
To what extent has President Mutharika been able to mend relations with donor countries?
Well, I think one thing that he did that is of significant importance is the fact that he pledged to have a lean cabinet of about 20 cabinet ministers. He's maintained that promise, and for the first time in the history of the country, we have a very small cabinet. He has also been a president who is not traveling quite a lot, both within the country and outside the country, thereby also demonstrating a certain measure of saving public resources. And I think these kind of measures that he's taken, in a way, small steps that go in the direction of restoring donor confidence and mending relations also with the development partners. But again, I must say, there is still a lot to be done that will prove that he can be the person who is eventually going to restore the public confidence in the government.
Political analyst Augustine Magalawando in Lilongwe.
Behind the headlines.
Back in March, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan convened a national conference to explore how the country's diverse and numerous cultural, religious, and linguistic groups could live together more peacefully. Nigeria is split into a mainly Christian South and a mainly Muslim North, and has been struggling with an Islamist insurgency since 2009. But that is only part of a complex picture. So, how much progress has been made towards ending the strife? The national conference has just wound up, and Sam Olukoya has been looking behind the headlines.
After sitting for more than 5 months, the national conference ended in a grand style, during which a conference report was presented to President Goodluck Jonathan. Even before going through the report, the president described the national conference as a success.
It is now very clear that as Nigerians, we have devised a way of addressing and resolving our differences amicably, with dialogue and dialogue until we agree. This is most heartwarming indeed.
Key recommendations of the national conference include the creation of more states, rotational presidency between the North and South, a new revenue-sharing formula among the different tiers of government, and the reversal to the old national anthem. Many insist that these recommendations do not address the issue of how the different groups in Nigeria should coexist. Mike Akpopola Ajayi, a member of the Odua Nationalist Coalition, a group advocating self-determination for the Yoruba ethnic group, says the national conference is a failure because it did not address the quest for autonomy by the various ethnic groups.
The people are yearning for greater autonomy and greater freedom. And that is why, you know, to us Yoruba, the major agenda is regional autonomy. And the second is right to self-determination, to the point of decision, to be included in the constitution. And anything short of that will only lead to chaos and further violence and intra-ethnic and religious conflicts, just like it is going on today.
The Yorubas are the second largest ethnic group in Nigeria. Like them, the Igbos, the third largest group in the country, are also seeking autonomy and possible secession from Nigeria. In the Niger Delta region, the minority ethnic groups are seeking control of the crude oil wealth in the area. Many Nigerians feel the country may head for a breakup if nothing is done to address the grievances of the numerous component parts. Dr. Sylvester Odong Ahene is a senior lecturer at the Lagos State University.
Will Nigeria remain, you know, as one country, or will it disintegrate? These are possibilities. Even if the country were to break, it is not something that is unnatural, you know, because Nigeria is a multinational state with different ethnic compositions and all of that. But it is in the interest of the black man for the country to remain at one. But for that to happen, you know, the country needs to be restructured in such a way that the component units can realize their aspirations.
The Islamist sect Boko Haram is seen as one of the biggest catalysts towards the breakup of Nigeria. In the last days, the group has taken control of several towns and villages in northeastern Nigeria. On Sunday, it declared the occupied territories a caliphate.
Sam Olukoya in Lagos. It's Ghana's only annual street arts festival, and it attracts musicians, artists, filmmakers, writers, designers, students and activists. It's called Chali Wati, and it's held in Jamestown. Now, in its fourth edition, it's given Ghanaian artists and performers international exposure, as Isaac Kaledche reports.
Jamestown, a historical suburb of the capital city Accra, was a completely different place over the last weekend. The town was covered with sights, sounds, and beautiful creations by Ghanaian and international artists. They call it Chalewati Festival, simply translated, My Friend, Let's Go. And it is a place where thousands of artists had a chance to showcase their works and do businesses. Ghanaians and foreigners alike had the opportunity to enjoy things like film screening, graffiti murals, theater performances, installations, live music performances, dance, and poetry, among others. Joya and her husband are from Germany.
Oh, we just came here to visit Accra, and then we just heard that there's this festival, and we searched it on the internet, and we thought that it's quite interesting that here's a big art festival in Accra. So we just stayed in Accra to see what there's going on. We're interested in arts, and I think it's quite cool that in Jamestown there's a big art stuff like that.
The festival is not just empowering Ghanaians to develop their talents in arts, but also providing jobs for them and linking them to international partners. Manche Ayikwe is one of the organizers of the event, which is in its fourth year.
We work with an organization called Accra.alt, and in 2011 we started the Chalewati Street Art Festival as a way of, one, bringing the creative community in Ghana and Accra together, and two, to figure out a way to create an ecosystem of a creative economy that feeds with one project feeding into another and also making art viable.
Abraham Brenya is coming from the second capital city of Ghana, Kumasi. He owns a stand of artistic jewelries. He tells about the significance of exhibiting his arts works at the festival.
I joined the street bazaar, and I'm proud to be here because there are so many things that we need to show the world. You know, as you can see, you know, some of my art I'm displayed. Yes, this is the handwork of my grandfather, and of course, I learned it from my grandfather.
Ajo Kisi is a college student. She too got an opportunity to display her 75-meter-long Victorian-era wallpaper. The wallpaper is telling a story about women.
It's a story about women. It's a story about freedom. It's a story about liberation. It's about women standing up and then ignoring the many societal limitations.
For the organizers, 4 years of this event in Jamestown, a community that holds much history about Ghana and its trades with foreigners, only shows that there are better days ahead.
Isaac Kelechi in Accra, ending there on a positive, cheerful note.
Opinion.
Would you like a pay rise? How about a salary increase of 600%? As we heard earlier in our programme, that was what 20 cabinet ministers in Malawi were asking for. What was your reaction on hearing of their demands? That question once again. What was your reaction on hearing that 20 Malawian cabinet ministers were asking for a 600% pay rise? Do let us know in an email to feedback.africa@dw.de. A text message to country code 491609575951 or in a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. And before we go, a reminder of our main stories. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has sacked government officials who defied an order to return home and help fight the Ebola epidemic. Defending her decision, Information Minister Lewis Brown told this programme, "We need all hands on deck." Malawi's President Peter Mutharika has blocked a 600% pay rise requested by 20 cabinet ministers. We've also been hearing about Nigeria's National Conference and its efforts to promote peace among the country's diverse and numerous cultural, religious and linguistic groups. More stories from and about Africa at the same time tomorrow, when we'll also be paying another visit to the Crossroads generation. As always, thank you for listening. From me, Mark Caldwell. Bye now.